I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The nine members on New Hampshire's Medicaid Expansion Study Commission sat down for the first time this week. Members picked a leader and set a schedule, but what they can accomplish remains to be seen. Governor Hassan started signing bills as they came across her desk. They include raising the speed limit on part of I-93 and allowing towns to keep bars open until 2 a.m. But it's been the weather that has kept the governor busy and many of us inside out of the rain. Flooding in the western part of the state has damaged homes and roads, and a swollen Merrimack River claimed two lives in a week. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We'll look at what's happened in the Granite State during the first 2 weeks of July. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you think the Medicaid Expansion Commission will reach a decision? Have you experienced flooding in your region? And as the state urges caution near fast-moving rivers, have you become more careful? The number to call is 1-800-892-6477 or 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also email us at exchange@nhpr.org. And joining me in the studio today for our roundtable discussion is Dean Spiliotis. He is civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website NewHampshirePoliticalCapital.com. Welcome to the program, or welcome back, Dean.
Hey, good morning, Sarah.
And Norma Love is State House reporter for the Associated Press. Good morning.
Good morning, Sarah.
And Ben Lubsdorf is staff reporter at the Concord Monitor. He covers New Hampshire politics and state government. And welcome to you.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So let's start with all of this rain. There's a little bit of a reprieve this morning, I have to say. But all of this flooding has, all this rain has meant flooding in western parts of the state. And Governor Hassan made two trips out to flood sites in the past week or so. Ben Lubsdorf, how bad is it really? What has she seen?
Well, obviously it's been raining for weeks. At times we've seen 2-3 inches in an hour in some areas, and you're going to get flooding when that happens. And especially in the southwestern part of the state, in the upper valley, there's been flash flooding that's taken out roads, taken out bridges. The governor declared a state of emergency, which, of course, opens up the possibility down the line of getting federal aid, FEMA aid, to help make repairs and compensate folks for what's going on. And with all the rain, rivers have been swollen and moving very quickly. Here in the Concord area, we saw two people drown in the Merrimack River in the space of just a couple of days. And that prompted state officials to issue a pretty urgent public warning to stay out of those rivers when it looks dangerous. So it's been a pretty bad couple of weeks with the rains. And the governor has been making trips out there, as you said, and trying to marshal some state resources to deal with it.
And the damage estimates seem to keep going up. I know at first they thought about $2 million, then FEMA was out there and thought it was more like $5 million. And Dean, I know you were watching as the governor was out in that part of the state.
That's right. Some pretty remarkable footage on the television. It's almost as though we're in the middle of a spring thaw and the rivers are running really high. There were these pictures of an apartment complex, a new apartment complex, I believe in West Lebanon, that was hit by a mudslide. Pretty remarkable damage. Yeah, one of the true tests for any chief executive, whether it's the president or the governor, is what I like to say, demonstrate that you can wear the windbreaker or the fleece, that you can get out there and respond to these natural disasters, any kind of crises. As we all know, John Lynch was masterful in doing this. Whenever there was any kind of natural disaster in the state, he was there almost immediately, meeting with residents, giving out his cell phone number. Governor Hassan has taken a page from his book and has been traveling up there, as Ben said, have a federal disaster declaration. Responding to these kinds of crises and the kind of press coverage that goes along with it can be very helpful to a governorship or detrimental if you don't respond. So they're taking it very seriously.
And Norma Love, I mean, that's a challenge for Governor Hassan kind of right away here.
I think it's ironic that right after the budget is signed or right in the middle of all of it, this happens. And what we have is a missing piece out of the budget, and that is to take care of roads and bridges going forward. The Senate wanted gambling to fund improvements, fix aid to local bridges, some of the things that communities need for these kind. I mean, FEMA isn't going to cover everything. Some of it's going to have to come out of local pockets. And the House wanted to raise the road toll, which is the tax on gas and diesel. And we don't have it. And so going forward, the Republicans in the Senate in particular and the Democrats in the House are going to have to get together and find something in the next session, because FEMA will pay part of it. The state might kick in a little for its roads and bridges, but that leaves a big gap. Bridges and roads that weren't even touched by the rain but that are slowly deteriorating.
And this is probably an argument that we're going to hear next session.
Yeah, Dean? I was just going to say, you know, we hosted a roundtable of legislative leaders here yesterday on the exchange, and they all mentioned exactly that. They're very concerned about the lack of funding for roads and bridges, and they said that will likely be one of the priorities going forward next session.
And I think folks across the spectrum, from Governor Hassan to Senate President Peter Bragdon to the Democrats in the House, have all said this is something that has to be addressed. It's a crisis in our state. What they can't agree on, as Norma said, is how to pay for any of it. Gas tax seems unlikely to happen at this point. The Senate Republicans staked out a pretty strong position on that this year. The House has not shown any interest in supporting expanded gambling. So it'll be interesting to see what emerges, if anything, as a potential funding solution.
Mm-hmm. And as you mentioned earlier as well, Ben, there were a couple of drownings in the Merrimack River and a couple of heartbreaking stories that went along. I know the Concord Monitor had some nice profiles of the two people who had drowned. Gary Krabby LaCroix and a 20-year-old Darren Graham of Penacook had both died in the past week. It seemed, in a sense, to come as a shock to a lot of people that that the Merrimack River was that dangerous.
Well, I think that when often, if you've swum in the Merrimack River, it's sometimes quite a lazy river. It's a nice place to swim at times. But when we have this much rain, when the river is that high, it's fast, and people can lose their footing and slip under, and it's very difficult to regain control at that point. And I think that's what we've seen in the last couple of weeks, that rivers can be much more dangerous than people expect, especially compared to lakes and ponds and things like that. I think that's why the state issued such an urgent warning after the second drowning, saying, make sure you know what you're doing when you get into a river, if you have to go at all.
I think it was the Merrimack isn't the only place where we had a drowning. I think there was a Massachusetts woman up in, right. I think it was the Saco in North Conway. Mm-hmm. They were wading out and slipped on some rocks, and one woman was rescued and one was not. This time of year, it's tempting, especially when it's been so hot,
right,
to go out and kind of dip your toes in. But some of these rocks are covered by algae. It's slippery. And, I mean, any fisherman who's ever gone wading out in some of these rivers and streams will know if you get swept under, it can be quite dangerous, especially if you're wearing the kind of waders that fill up with water.
And typically this time of year in the heat, the rivers are usually a few feet lower. So if you're typically used to swimming in a summertime river and now it's not only running but it's 3 feet deeper, it can be really dangerous.
Well, we should, it looks like, get a reprieve from some of the rain maybe this Saturday or so. It's supposed to lighten up, so we'll see. But let's turn now to the legislature and some of the ongoing work. The Special Commission to Study Medicaid Expansion met for the first time this past Monday. It was mainly organizational. They chose Jim Varnum as a chairman. What else did they set up, Norma?
Well, I think they kind of staked their ground a little bit. They talked about some of the questions they'd liked answered. And you had Andy Sanborn, who I think is pretty skeptical about the whole thing, saying, well, we need to go back and talk about Medicaid in general and how it started and what it does. And rather than expand a program that's not working, let's look and see if what we have is working. So we're going to have a session that looks at Medicaid. You had Cindy Rosenwald, who is supportive of Medicaid expansion, saying, well, those people who want to go an alternative route, like Arkansas, for example, where they are putting some of the people who are in the under 138% category of poverty through the marketplace, which is it's been called the exchange or the marketplace, which is this right now. There's only one insurer in there, but it's where you would go to buy your insurance, or it was subsidized, or it's this competition that's supposed to take place. We'll let them do it privately. And she said, well, I want to know is if you do that, is it going to cost the state more? Because under Medicaid rules, you can't get go privately without getting the same coverage that someone on Medicaid would get, or you need what they call as a wraparound policy. So they pretty much staked out their positions and said, well, let's have a couple of meetings to talk about the background and things we don't know, and then they'll go from there. And I presume that they'll have, as Neil Kirk said, possibly a minority report as well as majority report. Mm.
So as you're alluding to, there are 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans on this commission. And Ben, I mean, do you think it's likely they've kind of staked their claims? It's likely to be driven by these kind of partisan debate?
Well, I'd be surprised if this commission didn't, in the end, recommend some sort of expansion simply because of what you mentioned, that there is a Democratic majority on this, and that's a Democratic appointed majority. And that's something that the Senate Republicans agreed to as part of the deal that got a study commission to look at Medicaid expansion rather than expanding Medicaid through the budget as Governor Hassan wanted, as the House Democrats wanted. So there is a question about what sort of expansion they'll be looking at. If there is a modified, tailored expansion plan, could that attract some or all of the Republican votes on the commission? That's possible. But I think that it would be a surprise if this commission didn't recommend expansion. And in the end, it's important, but it's not the final call because we've gotten lots of signals that there will be a special session later this year that will vote on this, and that'll be when the rubber meets the road.
And one of those Republicans has said she may be open to a little bit of discussion. Nancy Stiles, let's hear from her.
I hope we all go in with an open mind and try to figure out what is the very best thing to do, how we can move forward to help citizens that need help, but also not put New Hampshire in a position where it is going to be picking up the cost of everything down the road.
So, Dean, what do you think that means for some of the discussion?
Well, you know, I think the political dynamics of this are fascinating. You have a group of Republicans who simply want to scuttle Obamacare in any way possible. So they're going to try to drag this out, I think, well into the next session. You have another group of Republicans who I think have legitimate questions about whether or not expanding Medicaid will solve this issue with using the hospital emergency rooms as a primary care facility. And they want to do a little bit of studying of the program. You know, and Democrats, they wanted to do this in August. I think they would have preferred to obviously just have the vote straight up. But October was the best they can do, so we're going to wait and see what happens.
And we will keep talking about Medicaid expansion when we come back after a short break. We'll also take your calls then.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR's summer car raffle has begun, and as usual, we're giving away some great prizes, including a new car later this summer. But when you get your tickets today, you put your name in the hat for the early bird prize, $2,000 in Irving Oil Gas gift cards. And if you're the winner, your name goes back in the hat for the other prizes, but only when you get your raffle tickets at NHPR.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from the Casino Ballroom in Hampton Beach, presenting the Fab Four Beatles tribute saluting various Beatles eras, Thursday, July 18th at 8 p.m. Tickets and information at CasinoBallroom.com. And from People's United Bank, offering a full line of services to help individuals, businesses, and communities succeed, People's United Bank would know how it can do. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender. It's 920. This is NHPR.
And this is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth, and for Laura Kanoy today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We're joined by a fine panel this morning, Dean Spiliotis, Norma Love, and Ben Lubsdorf. Welcome to you all again. And we were talking before the break about Medicaid expansion, and let's stay with that a little bit. And Norma Love, we were talking about Nancy Stiles and some of her specific concerns.
Well, one of Nancy's concerns is that if you don't do anything, there's an estimated 22,000 adults that are going to just be left out. These are people who would remain under 100% of poverty. They don't qualify for the exchange because under the federal law, you have to be above that to go through this private partnership process. And I think she would like to find a solution that involves possibly, as Dean was saying, some kind of as Ben was saying, some kind of a model that includes that exchange. So I think Republicans across the country are looking at a way to do it other than putting everybody simply on the Medicaid rolls, but having some of them handled privately. And that's as I said before, could be a little tricky. I think Cindy Rosenwald brought up the issue of will that cost the state more, because the state doesn't want to pay anymore. And some states have also put in what they call triggers, where the federal government is supposed to pay 100% for 3 years, and then it phases down to 90%. Maybe after 3 years, we'll get out or we'll vote on it again. We'll see where things are. What's the federal deficit? That's a big issue with the Republicans.
Sure. And Ben Lubsdorf?
Well, it strikes me that in all the discussions of the coverage canyon and, in fact, the whole Medicaid expansion debate, is that this was a debate that was never supposed to happen. As the Affordable Care Act was passed, Medicaid expansion was effectively mandatory for every state, even though it's a joint federal-state program. There were incentives or requirements in there that it happened. The Supreme Court last June made it optional. They said these federal government couldn't force states to do it. And now this is a debate that's playing out
in every
in 50
state,
states,
yeah.
In the District of Columbia, a slight majority of states, I think.
I saw you had reported only about six as of last count were undecided still.
And New Hampshire is one of them. And I think that obviously the Democrats wanted to expand this as part of the budget. They didn't get that. But there is, as Governor Hassan has said a few times, a path to expansion in the budget through this study commission. It'll make its report in mid-October. And the question then is, will there be an attempt to keep any vote from happening until the regular session next year? Will there be an attempt to have a special session this fall? The governor has obviously indicated that she hopes that there will be a special session. But the mechanics of that are still to be determined.
And she starts talking right away about the money we'll lose every day if we wait past January 1st as well. Dean Spilotis?
Right. That's true. And New Hampshire does have the option to opt in during any quarter during the year. So it's not a use it or lose it permanently. But this whole issue of opting out of Medicaid has really caught the Obama administration by surprise. You have some really big states like Texas and I think Georgia and a number of others where there are large numbers of people who are affected by this. And it's just, the Supreme Court decision for all the ways in which it helped Obamacare really threw them a curveball on this. And I think that's a problem for them, and they have to figure out how to get these states. They're going to have to do a lot more hand-holding and kind of urge these states to opt in over the next year. I think Ben's right. I think there's a very good chance that Republicans will try to push a vote off into the next session.
I think there's one other piece here that we have to mention, and that is the managed care network that the state is putting together for its existing Medicaid population. And they put in the budget a requirement that hospitals get in or lose out on any aid going forward. And they put in a deadline of July 1 to sign a contract or an agreement that they would finalize by August. So when this was mandatory, the three companies that bid to run New Hampshire's network thought they were going to have maybe 58,000 more lives, covered lives, which makes a difference in going forward in the economics. Certainly. So now you have this curveball where we're trying to get the network up. We're trying to figure out who's going to get the money to these covered lives and is it going to be enough. And the third piece is, and probably the most important piece, New Hampshire's Medicaid rate is so incredibly low that it's not attractive, and they keep trying to juggle this and that and the other thing within the amount of money that they're paying for Medicaid to make it attractive.
It's amazing how interconnected all of this has been.
Well, and because there are so many moving parts to the Medicaid system and to the various reforms that are being proposed, that there's something that lawmakers are talking about that the governor's office has indicated they want to pursue, which is something called a Section 1115 waiver. This is something that several states have tried. It allows you to make pretty broad changes to your Medicaid program in ways that aren't typically allowed under federal law. It allows you to try, in theory, innovative approaches to health care. It's supposed to be aid neutral. You're not supposed to be using it as a way to access a lot more federal money, though some people believe it could lead to greater federal aid. But that is something that was discussed during the budget process. There was talk about a special commission to help design that waiver application that didn't make it into the final budget. But Governor Hassan has indicated that she still wants to pursue this option. That's something that hospitals like because, as Norma said, Medicaid reimbursement rates in the state are pretty low. And if there is a broader solution that can be found that incorporates perhaps expansion, managed care, reimbursement rates, The disproportionate share hospital payments, the so-called uncompensated care payments that the state makes, the Medicaid enhancement tax that helps fund that. If they can find some way to fix all of this at once, you could get more bang for your buck.
So back to this Medicaid Expansion Commission. Ultimately, what do we think they might be able to accomplish? Do we think it's going to be a worthwhile endeavor?
I think they're going to come out with a report in October that will push for some kind of expansion. The question in my mind is, will they politically try to gather in a Republican here and there? They need at least two Republicans in the Senate to authorize Medicaid expansion. So just to go straight Medicaid expansion into the existing upcoming managed care network, I don't think it's going to do that. I think they're going to have to show the some people can go through the exchange and be covered that way privately. I think you're going to have some kind of a combination to get those votes.
I think Democrats were basically over a barrel here during the conferee negotiations. This is the best they could get. They had wanted to do it in August. They compromised on October. I think we're going to see a really fascinating internal battle among Republicans at the State House, some of whom want to drag this out as much as possible, others who want to have kind of a good faith effort to learn a little bit more about the impact of the program on expanding Medicaid. But it's going to be an interesting fall. I think there are a whole bunch of political dimensions to this that are just starting to take shape now.
And we're likely to see a special session. Ben, do you think that that's most likely what will happen this fall?
I do, simply because even if the president of the Senate, Peter Bragdon, doesn't want to call the Senate back, the governor can call a special session with a majority of the executive council, and that is a 3-2 Democratic majority on the council. So I think that's a real possibility.
One cautionary note on calling in a special session is getting enough people. When you call sessions in at odd times like that, people can be traveling. They can, 400 members in the House. You want to make sure if you call it, you have the people who are going to vote your way.
In the seats. Mm-hmm.
Correct.
So what questions do you have for our reporters if you'd like to join in on our roundtable discussion? The number to call is 1-800-892-6477 or 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. And Norma, let's stay with you for a minute and talk a little bit about the capital budget that Governor Hassan signed this week. It's for $245 million. How does that compare to previous capital budgets? I know the big item here is that $38 million for the women's prison, but how does it compare?
Well, they keep their budgets in the last several go-rounds have been pretty much the same. I mean, there's a certain amount, there's a ratio of what they borrow to what kind of income the state has. They try to keep that pretty close to, I think it's about 6 or 7%. So, and some of the $245 million is backed by what they call other funds, like highway funds. So the key point is what is out of your general tax base, and that's probably half of that. The biggest project is the women's prison, and I think that's $38 million. It's a 224-bed prison in Concord. Ben probably knows as much about it as I do. Behind the current prison, men's prison is, there's some property there. They're hoping to be able to use some of the same facilities.
And resources.
Correct.
And educational things, yeah.
Plus, you have a prison in the city. The jobs, I think Concord would probably like the extra jobs brought here from that prison. The reason I think it's kind of interesting is it's kind of prison by lawsuit because they were sued a year ago to...
That spurred this forward?
To spur this forward. It's like the mental health money in the budget. They were sued. Sometimes it takes a lawsuit to move people off the dime. And the women have had complained for a long time that they didn't have the same resources, the same programs. And finally, they're getting a prison, hopefully with the facilities to do that.
Ben Lubsdorf.
Well, and as you said, there was this class action lawsuit alleging that services provided to female inmates aren't the same as the services provided to male inmates. And the idea of having the new prison close to the men's prison is that you can share services, share programs. When Governor Lynch was leaving office late last year, he talked a little bit. He came in for an editorial board at the Monitor, and he talked about prison privatization. One of the models he was looking at was perhaps getting a private company to build a new women's prison and then leasing it to the state to operate. That plan hasn't gone anywhere. Prison privatization seems like a dead issue, at least for now. But I remember him talking about how every year they felt like the prisons are a black hole for money, that you're always sinking in lots of money for repairs to make these places less obsolete, less crowded. Finally, they couldn't keep that going anymore with the women's prison, and that's why there was, I think, very little opposition in the legislature to spending $38 million on this. It's the single largest item in the capital budget. It takes a lot of the oxygen out of the room for other projects. But there was a pretty big consensus, I think, that this needed to happen. There was one attempt on the House floor to pull the money out, and it got much fewer than 100 votes.
Yeah, getting back to Norma's original point there, you know, if you're going to have a correction system that has this kind of underlying philosophy where the potential for rehabilitation is at least part of it, you have to provide equal opportunities for that for both men and women. And the essence of those lawsuits was simply that women were not given the same opportunities and programs for counseling and education, et cetera, that the men were receiving. So we've been talking about this prison for a long time, and now it looks like within the next 2 or 3 years we'll finally have it.
I can remember covering news conferences in the executive council chambers over my career. Maybe 2 or 3 times studies that were done saying the women aren't getting the same programs as the men. It took a lawsuit. Mm-hmm. It really did to get this moving forward. And, I mean, knitting is not the same as learning how to do something that is going to get you a
job-related skill.
Exactly.
Yeah, so it looks like if all goes forward here that they hope to complete that prison by October 2016, I think I saw.
Yeah, they've got a long design process for this, but they have the land, and they think that they can start construction in early 2015. So that'll be towards the right about the time that we're having another budget debate.
Right. So, Norma Love, there were quite a few other bills. Maybe we can just do a quick touch on a couple of them that the governor signed into law in the past couple of weeks. One of them was increasing the speed limit on I-93 or a piece of I-93, something related to frivolous lawsuits, the Pathways to Work program. Bars can now stay open until 2 a.m. if their local community approves it. Kind of out of these, were any of these surprising to you to kind of go through, or that the governor signed or didn't sign?
Well, the Pathway to Work bill that she signed yesterday was a Democratic initiative in the Senate, although it passed 19-5. So it had Republican support. I think it's only going to affect maybe a dozen people
or so, yeah.
Because the criteria is pretty rigid. It's not just that you're going to exhaust your benefits. It's not just that you were permanently laid off and that you're not likely. I could think of newspaper people who might qualify, going to get a job back in your field, but that you have an idea. It's not something that there are 20 of in the city you're in. It's you have an idea. You have the energy. And either they'll help you or you have access to some kind of funding. I mean, it's pretty, and you're going to have to work 37, 40 hours a week.
And directly with the state.
Yeah, to make this happen and come to – they had something like this 20 years ago, and they probably helped maybe, 50, 60 people start businesses over a couple of years. The other bill that I thought was interesting was the bars. There was a huge hue and cry over changing the time from 1 to 2 a.m., and the compromise was, well, if your community says you can change it. And I think it's going to be kind of ironic for police officers who might be in one jurisdiction. They can't, the next jurisdiction over might have a later or an earlier time. So how do you enforce that? I'll just drive across the town line and go to the bar in the next town over.
Sure. Ben, do you think many towns will jump in on this? Do you think we'll see a lot of towns look at 2 a.m. closings?
Vermont and Massachusetts both have later closing times than New Hampshire. So I think if you're a community that's on the border that maybe wants to keep people from going across to bars in those states, this might be something that's attractive to you. But it struck me that as that bill went through the legislature, it kept on getting narrower. Originally, it was take the closing time statewide to 2 a.m. Then it was some communities could opt out and keep at 1 a.m. Then it became you have to opt in and go to 2 a.m. So I think that that's the story of a lot of legislation this year, including the speed limits bill. There were other broader proposals to raise the speed limit on state highways. In the end, they only approved one stretch of I-93 north of Concord, a rural road, except through the Notch, because that's obviously a narrower road. So I think that one of the reasons that the governor signed these bills is because they are fairly limited
proposals. Similar to medical marijuana as well, Dean.
Yeah, they did both end up in the end being fairly narrow, but they I find them interesting because they feed a little bit into kind of the live free or die ethos that we have up here, kind of a, you know, sort of baby steps towards more libertarianism in terms of your choices about patronizing bars or getting people up to the Lakes region as quickly as possible. You know, there are arguments on both sides. People say that these are beneficial economically. On the downside, people are concerned about safety issues or, you know, burning more fuel when you're driving at a higher speed, although supporters say people are already doing that anyway. But I always find these kinds of sort of lifestyle bills to be fascinating because of kind of the balance between, you know, social costs and individual rights.
And Ben, I saw you had reported last week, you looked at the legislature as a whole, and Dean, I know you touched on this yesterday, but in terms of, you found that about 36% of bills made it to the governor's desk or passed through?
Yeah, and that's about average for a legislature over the four previous years. So that's 2 years of Democratic control, 2 years of Republican control. About 36% of the pieces of legislation filed ended up becoming law. This year, about 36% of the pieces of legislation filed got to the governor's desk or have already been signed into law. So far, she hasn't vetoed anything. But one caveat on that is that something like 168 bills have been retained by House committees or re-referred to Senate committees for more work. Those bills will emerge probably early next year for more debate. But there's some pretty interesting issues caught up in there, including reforming the state's push-pull law, which is a very strict ban on push-pulls. There's a lot of concerns from national pollsters about that. A victims fund to reimburse victims of the FRM Ponzi scheme. A number of interesting bills that will get another look when the legislature comes back next year. And those could still become law.
Norma?
I thought it was interesting because you have a Republican Senate and a Democratic House that kind of you could tell early that there were certain issues that even though the Democrats might try to undo some things done by the Republican legislature last term, they just weren't going to happen. There was a lot more – there had to be a lot more compromise and agreement for things to go through. So you didn't have a lot of the big controversial issues, the right to work, let's repeal Reggie. You had medical marijuana, which they had agreed on and Lynch had vetoed. And you have a governor now who would sign it, although it has not reached her desk. So it was a different dynamic altogether because of the need to compromise.
And stay with us, everyone. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about Gabby Gifford's visit to the state. We'll talk about a new Northern Pass route. You can jump in on the conversation as well. Call 1-800-892-6477 or 1-800-892-NHPR or email us at exchange@nhpr.org.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. House Republicans overwhelmingly resist comprehensive immigration overhaul. Then, Egypt's military government calls for the arrest of Muslim Brotherhood leaders. And President Obama considers pulling all troops from Afghanistan after 2014. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Bedford Falls Assisted Living and Memory Care Community. With a team of dedicated caregivers working with families to improve the quality of aging, bedfordfallsassistedliving.com. And Prescott Park Arts Festival presenting the Common Man Restaurant Family Summer Musical Annie in Portsmouth now through August 25th. Open to the public, prescottpark.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
And this is The Exchange. I'm Sarah Ashworth, in for Laura Kanoy. Today it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Our panel includes Dean Spiliotis, Norma Love, and Ben Lubsdorf. And we're turning now to talking about guns in the news in the past couple of weeks. And last Friday, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and her husband Mark Kelly were in New Hampshire. They talked about expanding gun background checks. We also saw that Sturm Ruger announced it would open a new manufacturing plant in North Carolina, not New Hampshire. But let's start with Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly in their visit. Ben Lubsdorf, what was their message?
Well, this is their rights and responsibilities tour that they've been doing in across the country. But in a lot of states where there were senators who decided very late back in April not to support a proposal to expand background checks for firearm purchases, including North Dakota and New Hampshire, where Senator Kelly Ayotte was considered one of the decisive votes in preventing that measure from going forward. They weren't here saying vote Kelly Ayotte out of office, anything like that, but they were making the argument that this is a common sense proposal, that they're not targeting the Second Amendment rights of anyone to own or use a firearm, but that there are certain things that there's a broad support in the American public for, and expanded background checks are one of them. You know, it strikes me that we're almost 3 months after the vote in the Senate on gun control, and this issue has not gone away. We have seen repeated efforts, repeated successful efforts to keep this in the news, keep this on the front page here in New Hampshire. I don't know if people are starting to get a little fatigued with the issue, but it is a demonstration of the passion and the resources of some of these gun control groups who have made Kelly Ayotte sweat a bit over the last few months over her vote on that.
And we didn't see a lot of protesters at Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly's event in Manchester last Friday. It was pretty low-key, in a sense, Dean.
Yes, and to get to Ben's point, I think it's more going on here than just fatigue, but I do think fatigue is part of it. Yeah, I've been fascinated by the kind of sort of muted response that we've seen to the tour that that Giffords and Kelly have been doing. And I think the problem is that this is typically an issue that is fought on the left and right. So, you know, they come into the state. Mark Kelly is, wherever he goes from state to state, is buying guns or taking target practice, showing that they're not opposed to gun ownership, simply that they want to have these responsible solutions. So they've put themselves in this really difficult position in which progressives are upset with them because they're buying guns and elevating gun culture by going to firing ranges. And conservatives are upset with them because they think that Kelly is being a little bit of a poser, that he's not a true gun rights man because he's doing this these other activities with Gabby Gifford. So as a result, you know, legislatively, this is typically fought by people on the left and people on the right. The vast majority of Americans that we've referenced who sort of support responsible gun rights, you know, are often kind of bystanders politically. So they've put themselves in a kind of an unusual position, right? They're not the NRA on the right. And they're not the Bloomberg Mayors Against Illegal Guns group on the left. And so as a result, it seems to me as though no one knows quite what to do with them in terms of kind of policy. And in fact, there was an interesting note in one of the articles I read that said that the owner of the gun shop in Whitefield who sold Mark Kelly the rifle is now getting a lot of flack from people in his community for doing that. So they've put themselves in a tough spot. You know, for whatever struggles Gabby Giffords has had, this is typically not where the gun rights issues are fought.
Well, they had a picture of Gabby Giffords shooting a gun, and I saw that and I said, you know, that's not – it's smart. I kind of disagree with Dean. I think that what they're doing is they're trying to wake up the middle. And after Newtown, when you had little kids shot to death in an elementary school, I mean, and teachers who were trying to protect them, I think the middle is who they're reaching out to. And that is who they're going to need to get anything passed. That is who, you know, they call it the silent majority, the middle, whatever you want to say. If they don't get those people's voices calling their congresspeople, pushing for some kind of change, they're not going to get it.
But that's not where the battle is being fought, and that's not likely to happen, which is why I think it's problematic for them.
Well, I don't know that it's just going to be Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly that are fighting the battle. I think, you know, this is going to go all the way to the election. And I think New Hampshire is a very strong Second Amendment state. But I think within that, you're going to find voters who are going to say, yes, I believe we have a right to bear arms. But it's a little bit like abortion. You know, you either are way on the right or way on the left. But I think there are a whole lot of people in the middle.
And that's who Gabby Giffords and Mark Kelly, like you said, are targeting. Let's hear a little bit from Gabby Giffords right now from her visit in Manchester.
Now is the time to come together. Be responsible. Democrats, Republicans, everyone.
It's obvious that she's still recovering, and it's hard sometimes. You forget when you read comments that she's made. When you actually hear her voice, it's kind of a whole different level of passion that comes through, Ben.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I think this tour is happening, is because it is a very affecting thing for a lot of people to see someone who was shot in the head by a mass shooter coming around saying, I think that you should be able to own your guns, but we should have basic common sense protections, basic common sense measures to keep guns out of the hands of criminals like the one who shot me. And I think that if this is going to, as Norma said, affect the broad middle of folks who polls show that expanded background checks are very popular in New Hampshire, but it's clear with all the activism that's happened over the last few months that people who feel very strongly that there should not be are often louder than the people who feel very strongly that there should be more protections in there. So I think that if you're going to get the broad majority of folks who do support this sort of thing to get more engaged, as they haven't in past gun control battles, it's going to take something like this, and perhaps more than this, because, again, there was this somewhat muted response to her visit. We'll see what they do as the election does come up. For Senator Ayotte, she's not up until 2016, but you know, I don't think that this is the last vote that the Senate's going to take on gun control.
And that's interesting. You know, that's why they were here in New Hampshire, one of the seven states they made sure to stop in. Let's turn now to Sturm Ruger just briefly. They chose North Carolina for its third new manufacturing plant. One of the reasons that the company cited was that North Carolina is a right-to-work state. Ormolove?
Well, when I saw that, I thought, well, I can see what former House Speaker Bill O'Brien's campaign slogan is going to be, because he fought very hard to make New Hampshire a right-to-work state. And basically what right-to-work states you don't have to belong to a union in New Hampshire. But what we have is the state staying out of collective bargaining so that a company and its workers can negotiate a contract that either says, yes, you do have to be in our union or pay a fee to be part of this company or not. It's up to the two parties privately to negotiate that. And in right-to-work states, that person can't be forced to pay a fee, essentially an administrative fee, to handle any of the union's negotiating costs. And I think that it's an interesting that they also said they weren't going to close any plants in New Hampshire, that they were
still committed to
New Hampshire. It's a Second Amendment state, but they wanted to expand in North Carolina. But I can see the campaigns coming forth if Bill O'Brien goes forward with his congressional campaign.
Ben Lubsdorf?
Well, and I don't think that, barring something changing, New Hampshire is going to become a right-to-work state anytime soon. You know, we came close in 2011 when Speaker O'Brien was pushing for this. It passed. Governor Lynch vetoed it. And they came up just short on the override. And that was with a 3-1 Republican majority in the legislature. You know, a right-to-work bill came back this year and didn't come close to passing the House. So unless you see that sort of wave again of Republican control and the governor is a Republican, I don't think that this is going to go in short. It has become not just a partisan issue. Democrats are generally opposed to right to work, but there were also in the last session pro-union Republicans who provided the necessary votes to block an override. And yeah, I think that's not going to change anytime soon.
And I think that's the key. I think what you have are people who believe that government should stay out of basically out of the business world, that the government shouldn't dictate to the business you can or can't do these things in your negotiations with your employees. And then there are some who say, no, we've got to have this in the law so that we are listed as a quote-unquote right-to-work state. And until you have a consensus, which I don't – we've had this debate for years before it came so close last session, until they have some kind of consensus around it that, yeah, we want to do that, it's not going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And Sturm Ruger also did talk about incentives that North Carolina was able to offer as well. It's kind of another piece that it wasn't just right to work either.
And it's tough in these situations to say it's one piece of legislation,
right,
one law that makes it, you know, energy prices in New Hampshire are pretty high. There are other reasons that you could say it makes more business sense to do that. What's notable is that it wasn't ideological. They said New Hampshire's Second Amendment state. They're not closing the plant here. There was some talk after the amended gun control debate that gun companies might move from Connecticut with its now strong gun control laws, and that hasn't necessarily come to pass. So business usually trumps ideology.
Well, let's look at Northern Pass. At the very, very tail end of June, PSNH unveiled a new route for its joint Northern Pass project. To me, it seemed to catch a lot of people by surprise. A lot of people, they had missed many self-imposed deadlines. It caught a lot of people by surprise, was my sense. Ben?
Well, and the proposal that they unveiled is an interesting one. For years now, Northern Pass has been arguing that it needs to have these somewhat large, 135-foot-tall, many places, towers, that it would be too expensive to bury the lines. Now this new map buries the lines for a stretch of thing. About 8 miles of the lines would be buried. And that is opening the door to people saying, well, if you can bury 8 miles of the line, why can't
why not
you bury
more
of the lines? And I think that we've seen that from Governor Hassan, from Senator Shaheen, from Senator Ayotte. They've become a little more strong in their statements, indicating that maybe burying the lines is not a bad idea for more of this thing. And none of them have come out and said, we support this project yet. None of them have said, we oppose this project in any form. Everyone's keeping their lines of communication open, but this project's going to require federal approval. It's going to require some form of state approval. And
it's far from over.
It's not. I didn't see any people saying, well, with this new map, all of our concerns are addressed and we completely support this project. I think they're not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Dean?
Yeah. The issue all along has been that sort of the northern 40 miles of what's, I think, about 150-mile stretch of right away for this project, and they did it. They did announce they're moving the route to the east, which will avoid some of these populated areas where there have been issues about property values. It's going to add a couple $100 million to the project, but it's only 8 miles out. I think that the whole project is about 190 miles long. So we're talking about a very small percentage. And as Ben said, people are now saying, well, why don't you bury more? My kind of general sort of political intuition on this is that a lot of people are dug in, that it's almost irrelevant what PSNH and the utilities decide to do, because people are dug in on both sides. And I've heard members of both parties in the state legislature, our congressional delegation and governors, all now saying, you know, that kind of the jump off point is, you know, if this is even going to happen at all, they're probably going to have to bury more than just 8 miles. And it was fascinating to me. You know, it was a little bit of a surprise that they announced the route. But, you know, I looked at kind of the opposition groups to see if they would move at all after the announcement. And it was just, you could hear the crickets. It was just kind of a collective yawn. So this has become one of those sort of ideological issues about the nature of the provision of power and the impact on the environment, where I think there aren't a huge group of people who are waiting to see, well, will you do 20 miles instead of 8 miles or 30 miles? This is going to be a long fight. People are dug in.
Norma? I mean, Dean's exactly right. In fact, the Society for Protection of New Hampshire Forests thought they had blocked the route. They thought they had bought key conservation easements and that they had successfully blocked Northern Pass in that area. And I think they might have been caught a little bit by surprise that they were, I don't know if you'd say outfoxed, but certainly at this point they've come up with an alternative route and apparently have negotiated what they need to take it to the next step. And that's the key, the next step, and which is they need the Federal Department of Energy has got to have some environmental impacts studies. They've got to have hearings. And the state also has to get involved. And the legislature did not put a moratorium on this project. But what they did do was say that the committee, the site evaluation committee that looks at these kinds of projects, should have its criteria reviewed. They should study what they're doing, because it's not just Northern Pass. It's wind towers. It's other things. What exactly are we using to measure visual impact, other impacts, impacts that they probably didn't even think about when the committee was formed? Mm-hmm. So they have to go through these steps. And as Dean said, they're going to be fought along the way. They're going to be fought along the way at regulatory steps, possibly legally.
And here at the very end, too, I just wanted to mention something we had a little fun with and a lot of people on social media had fun with this week as well, that NBC News showed a map that inadvertently left New Hampshire off of it. But they gave us a great apology. Let's hear a little bit of that.
And finally, about last night's broadcast, we covered this terrible train explosion in Canada, and we showed a map when we were zooming in to correspondent Katie Turr's live report. But play that back and hold it, and you'll see what a few of our sharp-eyed viewers saw, including at least one U.S. senator. New Hampshire's gone. vanished. It apparently moved to Vermont, and then New York took over a bunch of territory. Nobody knew it. Mea culpa and full disclosure, New Hampshire was lost by our graphics department.
So we can blame the graphics department, I guess. It's a little disheartening, maybe.
Well, Ben, it's kind of cool because, you know, often TV does not correct its mistakes this quickly or this extravagantly. After Brian Williams issued that mea culpa, he then gave a bunch of reasons why New Hampshire is great.
Including for Tupperware, for paper
Tupperware,
towels.
Sarah Silverman, First in the Nation primary.
All women congressional delegation.
He correctly pronounced Winnipesaukee. I mean, I think that there was a olive branch here because obviously NBC will be back in 2016 when we have a primary and they don't want people to throw stuff at them for this. So I think that they did good.
And Dean Spiliotis, it was a...
It was anybody who watches, you know, a lot of sort of the political shows and political humor on TV knows that Brian Williams has a good sense of humor. And I think he handled it perfectly. And fortunately, he didn't, you know, say Berlin instead of Berlin or something like that, which would have carried it out another day. I think they did a nice job with it.
So we ended up getting more out of it in the end. So I want to thank all of you for being here today on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We were joined today by Dean Spiliotis. He's civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, and author of the website NewHampshirePoliticalCapital.com. Norma Love is State House reporter for the Associated Press. And Ben Lubsdorf is staff reporter at the Concord Monitor. He covers New Hampshire politics and state government. Thanks to you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm and Alan Cohen. Our intern is Tim Camerato. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Sarah Ashworth in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
The Exchange. It gets New Hampshire talking. Whether it's schools or alternative fuels, the economy or astronomy, transportation, immigration, or what it means to be first in the nation. It's been said that the public interest is best served by the free exchange of ideas. I'm Laura Canoy. Be part of our exchange weekday mornings at 9 here on NHPR.
Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR. New Hampshire weather partly